This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, thousands flee the Aleppo countryside in Syria. Canada gets a new prime minister, Justin Trudeau.
This is what positive politics can do.
Human rights groups unhappy with China's president visiting London. Back to the Future is here after three decades. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Thousands of Syrian villagers are fleeing homes in the countryside south of Aleppo in the face of a government ground assault backed by Russian airstrikes. It's one of four major offensives mounted since Russia's military intervention in the long-running Syrian civil war. 3 weeks into the Russian air campaign, no ground assault's been launched by government forces in major rebel-held urban areas. In the countryside south of Aleppo, UN officials estimate about 35,000 villagers are on the move to escape relentless and often indiscriminate Russian bombing raids. In a conversation with International Edition host Susan Yaki, VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden says Iran is also heavily involved.
Well, Iran has been a longtime supporter of the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. And when you hear talk of Syria, it's referred to sometimes as a Russian proxy state, as a key ally of Moscow. But it's also been a key ally of the Iranian regime. And so Iran's long had an interest in propping up the government of Bashar al-Assad and trying to ensure that the Sunni rebel groups, including the likes of Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, didn't gain too much of a foothold. Iran's been there for quite some time, but of late its presence has been ramped up significantly and has become much more visible in recent weeks as the Russians have started the air campaign and increasingly bombed rebel targets in an effort to protect President Bashar al-Assad.
Well, if Iran is jumping in and Russia's using its air power to cover the Syrian government, it seems like the anti-Assad forces are really in trouble.
Well, in some ways they are, because if you look at the numbers, there are thousands of rebel forces, but there are upwards of perhaps 10,000 forces that are in some way loyal to the Syrian regime, including the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps, which has a number of folks in there, some top military commanders, perhaps up to from several hundred to a few thousand actual troops. You also have several thousand Hezbollah fighters, Hezbollah, a terror organization funded in almost an Iranian proxy in the Middle East, with the potential of calling several thousand more in from Lebanon. And you also have what's been an ongoing effort by Iran to recruit Shia militia, Shia fighters from a variety of places, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, and notably Iraq, where they've sent in several thousand fighters to help bolster the Syrian Arab army that's loyal to President Assad.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden talking earlier with International Edition Susan Yaki. We now take a brief turn back to the future. Social media correspondent G. Abby Lee is here with us to tell us what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
Gee, what's the Twitter world saying about October 21st, 2015, today?
A lot of articles about how the movie portrays the future, often pretty accurately. For example, the Scientific American magazine tweeted a link to a story that listed nine devices we enjoy today that appeared in Back to the Future. Ray, I don't want to give everything away, but they do include a skateboard that floats in the air and cell phones. I know it sounds bizarre that something so commonplace and rather outdated is included in that list. I mean, who uses plain cell phones anymore? Smartphones, tablets, and smartwatches are more commonplace than mobile phones, at least here in America. Fun fact, I wanted to mention that Scientific American is the oldest continuously published magazine in the United States. It's on Twitter, at SciAM, that's S-C-I-A-M.
So exactly how much hype is around the movie and the big day?
For that, I turned to the Topsy Analytics website. In the last 24 hours, hashtag Back to the Future was used in nearly 16,000 tweets. Hashtag BTTF2015 was used more than 4,000 times in the same time frame. And it's not just American news outlets sharing articles either. The BBC and Australia's Sydney Morning Herald are also tweeting about the big day.
You know, gee, I saw that movie when it originally came out. It was a monster hit. Mm-hmm. Never would have thought 30 years later we'd be doing this, but that's Back to the Future. And that's where we're going. Is there a Back to the Future official account on Twitter?
There is. There's an account with the handle at Back to the Future. The account description says it's the official source for the latest movie news and upcoming events, but the account isn't verified by Twitter.
Well, maybe not just yet, but perhaps. What is that account tweeting?
It's retweeting about events related to the movie. So they include one from the Radio City Music Hall in New York with photos from the Back to the Future concert held there last week. Another example is a retweet from the Universal Pictures Home Entertainment, which advertised the movie's 30th anniversary trilogy on Blu-ray. That's all from me.
Thanks, G. We'll have more on the movie Back to the Future later in the program. You can follow G on Twitter at GABBYLEE. That's GEEABBEYLEE. She also tweets from our VOA International Edition account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. President Obama committed to working with Canada's Prime Minister-designate Justin Trudeau on a range of issues, including climate change and trade promotion, during a congratulatory phone call Tuesday. Mr. Trudeau became Canada's next and second youngest prime minister after leading his Liberal Party to a commanding victory in Monday's parliamentary elections. The Liberal Party won majority status, ending 9 years of Conservative Party rule. Mr. Trudeau, who is 43 and eldest son of the late Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, addressed jubilant supporters Tuesday in Montreal.
This is what positive politics can do. This is what a positive, hopeful vision and a platform and a team together can make happen. Canadians from all across this great country sent a clear message tonight. It's time for a change in this country, my friends, a real change.
Mr. Trudeau has promised at least 3 years of deficit spending on infrastructure, higher taxes for the rich, closer ties to the United States, and an end to Canada's participation in U.S.-led airstrikes against the Islamic State group. The Conservative Party, under Mr. Trudeau's predecessor, Stephen Harper, will assume the position of official opposition with the left-of-center New Democracy Party, a distant third, followed by the separatist bloc Quebecois. China's President Xi Jinping addressed Britain's parliament Tuesday at the start of a four-day state visit, one London is touting as an opportunity for the two countries to boost trade and investment, while human rights advocates urge questions about China's human rights record. Mr. Xi was greeted by Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace during a lavish welcoming ceremony and later in the day at a banquet. His four-day trip also includes talks Wednesday with Prime Minister David Cameron. The Prime Minister's office said this week that $46 billion worth of deals will be completed and that Britain and China will also discuss cooperation related to the threat of terrorism and extremism. Human rights advocates are planning protests throughout the Chinese president's visit and calling on Mr. Cameron to address China's human rights record. Speaking with International Edition host Sarah Williams, Freedom Now Executive Director Maren Turner says her group is urging Mr. Cameron to call on China to set detained Chinese Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo and his wife Liu Xia free.
Liu Xiaobo has been in prison since the very end of 2009, and his wife, Liu Xia, has been kept under house arrest since the end of 2010 when it was announced that her husband would be the recipient of that year's Nobel Peace Prize. And unfortunately, this case has gone on and on and on far longer than we expected. And it's a very clear-cut case of persecution by the Chinese government. When you look at the trial that was conducted against Liu Xiaobo, where he was accused of subversion, the evidence used against him were merely his writings, and they were not writings that were calling for the overthrow of the government. They instead were merely writings calling for democratic reform and for authorities to respect the human rights of the citizens. And for that, he received an 11-year sentence. And what we are doing now is calling on the heads of state who engage with the Chinese government, which at this point I think includes every government certainly in the world. And we've made these calls, we've made similar calls to President Obama in the past. And on the occasion of the Chinese president's visit to the United Kingdom and to London to meet with the prime minister, it's the perfect occasion for Mr. Cameron to raise the case of Liu Xiaobo and Liu Xia and call for their release.
Now, this is occurring as it seems like all the stops are being, you know, pulled out for the Xi visit. Mr. Xi scheduled to address Parliament. He's also going to attend a state banquet at Buckingham Palace. However, Prince Charles, who's the heir to the throne, is not going to attend that banquet. He has not said anything, I believe, publicly, but apparently he is friends with the Dalai Lama and is very concerned about the situation in Tibet. And also, I believe the opposition leader, Labour Party head Jeremy Corbyn, has said he will bring up China's human rights situation with Mr. Xi. So it seems like there's kind of a mixed reaction in Britain to Mr. Xi's visit.
Well, I think that's right. And it's not surprising because the human rights record of the Chinese government, going beyond just the case of Liu Xiaobo, is pretty dismal. And I think Prince Charles long time been aware of that. And as you mentioned, he is friends with the Dalai Lama, so he's well aware of the situation in Tibet. I applaud his move if it is indeed because he is essentially boycotting having a formal visit with the president. And I also applaud the move by Jeremy Corbyn as well. And I hope that they do raise Liu Xiaobo's case, as I believe that they have and they will. And it's a shame, unfortunately, that the prime minister doesn't feel the same way. I mean, we certainly understand that there are a number of priorities that the United Kingdom has with China, and human rights is not necessarily at the top of that list.
That's Maren Turner, Executive Director of Freedom Now, speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. Almost 400 mostly elderly South Koreans arrived in North Korea Tuesday for long-awaited reunions with relatives they've been separated from since the Korean War of the early 1950s. The emotional reunions are taking place at the North Korean resort of Mount Kumgang until Thursday. This is the latest in a series of such reunions, says a historic inter-Korean summit in 2000, but just the second one in 5 years. And after the two sides reached an agreement in August to ease rising tensions that had pushed them to the brink of another armed conflict. Troy Stangerone of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute told International Edition's Victor Beatty it is an emotional and rare experience, as these families have been separated for decades, as if a physical wall barred them from seeing their loved ones.
There's only been maybe about a dozen family reunions since the end of the Korean War. Very small number of Koreans have met or even had a chance to really interact and speak in any way with their relatives. This is sort of one of the big differences between the division with Germany, to where you had people able to travel between the two countries, call each other, you know, write letters, send packages. We may have had the physical wall in the case of Germany and Berlin, but you've had a real wall between the two people. So it's very significant, especially now that, you know, some 70 years later, many of the people who had relatives are very old and are beginning to die off.
Is it too early to read the tea leaves and suggest that something may be afoot with regard to relations between the North and South?
I think at this point, it's one of those things where we have to look at it step by step. This came out as part of the agreement that ended the crisis in August. It was somewhat of a surprise as it wasn't part of the South's initial demands, but this is essentially the first step in what Park Geun-hye, when she first came to office, had suggested should be the policy of engagement towards North Korea, which is let's start by bringing the families back together, start rebuilding a relationship between the two countries. So I think the real key is, one, the North in the past has had a proclivity to taking cancellations at the last minute. So as long as it continues and goes through, that's a positive step. And then two, if we can make this a more normalized process. And I think if it becomes a more normalized process, then we can start talking about progress between the two countries going forward on a much different scale.
Of course, South Korea's leader, Ms. Park, was in Washington just last week. Any linkage between the two events?
I think it's important in the sense that the United States is very supportive of South Korea engaging the North. And I'm sure that President Obama and President Park talked about this and the importance of the families coming together, and that the U.S. is completely supportive of trying to take and help make that as possible. Beyond that, it's one aspect of the broader North Korea policy, I think.
Is there anything to be made of the fact that the North Korean anniversary earlier this month went by without any rocket launch or any nuclear test of any kind?
Yeah, I think this is significant for a couple of reasons. One, the North had come out and made statements that they were going to test both their missiles and their nuclear weapons. And China sent a high-level delegation to the anniversary. One would think that the Chinese are putting pressure on them to not conduct further tests. But it's significant because had that happened, it could have placed these reunions in jeopardy, which would have then set relations between the North and South back further. So I think it's significant both from a strategic level that they haven't taken and engaged in additional tests. And it's also important on the inter-Korean level that it allowed this to go forward.
A second group of 250 South Koreans will arrive at Mount Kumgang Saturday for another 3 days of reunions. Coming up, a look forward to Back to the Future. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
There are 300 million smokers in China, and now by age 20, two-thirds of young Chinese men are smoking cigarettes, increasing their chance of premature death by 50%, according to a new study published in The Lancet. Researcher Zhengming Chen at the University of Oxford says that cigarette smoking in China has accompanied the country's economic growth.
Since, you know, 1990s, with the rapid economic development opened up, and China suddenly produced a very large quantity of cigarettes.
The study's authors say that if the trend continues, by 2030, as many as 2 million Chinese men will be killed by tobacco each year. By contrast, smoking rates among women in China have dropped sharply. About 10% of older Chinese women smoke, but only about 1% of middle-aged women are lighting up. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, took a major step this month toward becoming the world's biggest ever regional free trade zone. The United States was among 12 Pacific Rim nations that reached agreement on the rules of the free trade zone on October 5th. Those nations say the TPP will promote their economic growth, improve governance, and strengthen labor rights and environmental standards. Some of those 12 nations already have free trade deals that give each other preferential treatment beyond the requirements of the World Trade Organization, or WTO. Andrea Bubala is an economics professor at Columbia University. Speaking Tuesday to our hashtag VOA TV program, Bubala said TPP nations that don't already have preferential arrangements could be the big winners from the deal.
Vietnam is really one country that did not have a preferential trade agreement with other countries of TPP. So Vietnam is one country that is going to benefit a lot from it. Malaysia, perhaps, as well. So these are the more tangible economic gains that they may come up out of TPP. I think it will take time to see what's going to happen next. My hope is that TPP is not going to act as an obstacle to the WTO, which to me is clearly the most important way to liberalize trade at the multilateral level, not at the preferential level.
The Obama administration says a TPP would be good for American workers because it would eliminate 18,000 foreign tariffs placed on American-made exports. One organization that agrees is the American Apparel and Footwear Association, which represents more than 1,000 U.S. brands. Its chairman, Rick Helfenbein, spoke to hashtag VOA about what he sees as the main benefit of the TPP.
It's going to knock down a lot of borders. You know, you think of things like as simple as wine, which we grow quite a bit of in California. You want to ship that wine to Japan, it's a 58% duty. You want to ship cheese to Japan, it's a 30% duty. We have blocks in every place we could grow markets, and TPP will break some of those walls down.
But the TPP also would require the U.S. to remove barriers on many foreign imports, increasing the competitive pressures on American companies. Some Americans fear those pressures could result in U.S. job losses, and those concerned Americans include members of Congress who have to approve the deal. President Obama has not said when he will notify Congress that he intends to sign the TPP, a notification that would give lawmakers 90 legislative days to either vote yes or no. Carlton English is a reporter for the Street.com financial news site. She gave hashtag VOA her view on what the president may do next.
I think one of the first things Obama wants to see is a favorable Congress, and this is a very controversial deal. So finding a Congress that is favorable is going to be difficult. The other thing to think about is we are well into our election cycle for the next president. And, well, actually not just president, but also several members of Congress who may not want to vote on a controversial deal just before November elections in 2016. So I think it's going to be kind of interesting to see exactly how they time this one.
The White House says it wants to give Congress ample opportunity to consider the TPP, but at the same time does not want to subject the deal to what it calls unnecessary delay. Movie fans 3 decades ago saw a film that sparked the imagination of what life might be like just a couple of decades into the future. The day in that movie is here, and so is International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
October 21st, 2015. This is the day in the movie Back to the Future 2 when the main character Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, arrives in the future from 1989. Now, many fans of the movie have been waiting for this actual day to arrive, and now that we are in the future, what did the movie get right in predicting our current life, and where did it fall a little short?
The future.
To start, the headsets worn at the dinner table resemble what we know as Google Glass and a few other competitors. Flat-screen TVs are a reality, as is video conferencing through computers and smartphones.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your hoverboard.
Where is it?
Yes, there's that matter of the hoverboard, a skateboard that floats on air, but not water, as Marty finds out when he's being chased.
Hey, McFly, you bojo!
The bus don't work on water!
Unless you've got power!
By the way, car company Lexus recently introduced a hoverboard that utilizes magnets and superconductors to defy gravity. It even emits steam due to the science behind the superconductors at work. The Lexus model won't be for sale, though, but this development does lay the groundwork for future hoverboard technology to eventually become a reality. Flying cars? Not even the fancy DeLorean that brought Marty to 2015 is off the ground today, although there are some manufacturers now vying to develop cars with wings.
This is a video game!
My dad taught me about these.
It is Wild Gunman.
How do you play this thing?
I'll show you, kid. I'm a crack shot at this.
You mean you have to use your hands? That's like a baby's toy.
In a humorous moment, Marty saunters over to show some young kids how to play an ancient video game until they totally diss his skills. Perhaps there's a local arcade near you that features vintage games you could pump some quarters into and give it a try. One of the boldest predictions from the movie, the Chicago Cubs beat a team from Miami to win baseball's World Series for the first time in more than a century. You know, in 1989, there wasn't even a team in Miami, as there is now. And the Cubs are in baseball's playoffs right now, close to reaching the World Series. We'll have to wait for that to play out and see if Back to the Future got that right. Back to the Future 2 is indeed back. It's in theaters today to mark the occasion. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
Along with Back to the Future 2, another popular movie from decades ago has a new installment. Star Wars is back with The Force Awakens, and ticket sales are going through the roof, setting records. And on this October 21st, we say a very happy birthday to Carrie Fisher, who we know as Princess Leia in the original Star Wars trilogy. Carrie Fisher is now 58 years young. That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In its annual Religious Freedom Report to the U.S. Congress, the Department of State noted three strong trends in 2014. First, the most egregious and violent cases of persecution based on religious intolerance were perpetrated by violent extremist groups, who seem to be bent on eliminating any religious practice that differs from their narrow and violent ideologies. Second, some governments failed or were unable to protect their populations from abuse by such violent groups. And finally, some governments restricted religious practice or speech through the use of discriminatory laws as well as arbitrary arrest, imprisonment, even execution. Around the world, a number of violent extremist organizations sought to murder or enslave any group or individual not conforming to their narrow interpretation of religious precepts. This included, among others, Daesh, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram. The damage done by such groups was exacerbated by the failure of some governments to act quickly enough or at all to protect the victims. Some governments claimed to be the protector of religious minorities, but failed or were unable to stop religiously motivated extremist attacks. Others failed to prevent, stop, investigate, prosecute, or punish religiously motivated violence, creating a culture of impunity. Worse still, a number of governments passed and enforced laws that punished religious minorities or discriminated against certain religious groups. Laws against blasphemy and apostasy were used to persecute and exact grossly excessive punishments, up to and including death, in the name of protecting majority religions from insult. Still other governments persecuted and punished practitioners of certain religions under the guise of combating extremism and terrorism, or forced religious groups to officially register and abide by a very narrow set of regulatory laws. Religious bigotry is present to a degree in every continent and every country, and sadly, even including our own. It may be expressed through anti-Semitism or prejudice against Muslims, through the persecution of Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, and others. Or it may come in the guise of attacks against religion itself, said Secretary of State John Kerry in his introduction to the Religious Freedom Report. By issuing this report, we hope to give governments an added incentive to honor the rights and the dignity of their citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.